Judge, the next case is number 25-1701, Bioagilytics Labs LLC versus James McNally et al. At this time, would counsel for the appellant please come to the podium and introduce himself on the record to begin?
Thank you. Miguel Lopez on behalf of Bioagilytics, the appellant. Your Honors, may I reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal?
You may have three.
Three. Thank you. Your Honors, the district court here abused its discretion in denying the preliminary injunction motion without making any reference whatsoever to Bioagilytics' trade secret claims, non-compete claims, and claim for breach of the return of documents provision. In its 269-word order, it failed to comply with Federal Rule Civil Procedure 52A2, which says that in granting or refusing an interlocutory injunction, the court must state the findings and conclusions that support its action just as it would in a bench trial. And to underscore the importance of subpart 2, subpart 3 makes the point that this requirement's not necessary, not required for other types of motions. So the fact that it's a preliminary injunction does not mean that it's sort of a provisional determination that does not merit.
All right, so in light most, all right, I get the argument. It's not a hard argument to get your mind around. I guess if I'm going to try to push back, he says that they are general, the plaintiff's arguments are general and speculative. And then at the bottom, he says these deficiencies exist for each of the four factors. And so one of those would be irreparable harm. And when you have irreparable harm, you can't have generality and speculation. You need to point to something clear, the harm that will happen. And so if I'm doing my best to make this something that I can say what was decided, it's at least that there was no irreparable harm here because your claims were general and speculative, and therefore that's why I, the judge, have ruled that way. What's wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with that is that a few things. First, this court's own precedent states that you can't just make a general conclusion as to all the factors. Instead, you have to make the conclusions as to each element of each claim presented, and that's TEC Engineering from 1996. When looking at the various...
But you don't have to decide things you don't need to, right?
I'm sorry?
You don't have to decide or things you don't need to get to your bottom line, right?
Well, in this circuit, likelihood of success is the
okay,
primary
pillar, right,
but
not required if you fail on the other ones.
Sure.
So if it's a if your claims are general and speculative, you sort of, by definition, haven't shown irreparable harm.
If that were the case, however, in not making any findings of fact or conclusions of law, there is no basis to find, or there's no basis for your honors to find that the district court was correct in finding that there was no irreparable harm.
Counsel, I guess to follow up on Judge Aframe's question, saying that something is speculative is really a word that judges use all the time to show, to indicate that you haven't proved that you're going to be harmed. In other words, part of what we always look at for harm is, have you given some very concrete facts based on which we can conclude that there's a real likelihood that you're going to be harmed? And if you don't provide those facts, then a court concludes, well, your harm, allegations of harm are speculative. So that is actually, I think, a factual finding that the judge made here. So one question I have for you is, in terms of irreparable harm, as I understand it, the defendants here submitted, I'm not sure what the right word for it, almost sort of like a set of things that they said that they would do to address concerns that your client raised, both about providing confidential information and or trade secrets, and about working for a company that you view as a competitor. They say it's not really a competitor, but in any event, they made a series of concessions in writing about what they would agree to do, including a cooling off period, et cetera. So in light of those that were in the record and the district court saying that basically you had just speculative allegations for your harm, why isn't that enough for us to at least conclude that the irreparable harm factor hadn't been met?
2 points. The offers made by defendants were illusory. We're 8 months or more into this, and there still has been no forensic remediation, which is something that McNally agreed to in Section 7 of his employment agreement. So that's a contractual right. As for the irreparable harm, the district court, if you found that, is just wrong. This court has stated that a fact finder may not reject testimony that's unrebutted. That's Quintana Ruiz, First Circuit 2002. And in this case, the forensic expert submitted a declaration stating and providing evidence that McNally had bioanalytics documents on his Google Drive, which he was not allowed to access from his bioanalytics laptop, but he did hundreds of times. That he printed at least two of the documents that we identified as containing trade secret material. Critically, that he connected via Google Remote Desktop to three personal computers from his bioanalytics laptop, including on the last day of his employment. All of these are concrete and specific, and the case law makes very clear that irreparable harm is presumed when the trade secrets are misappropriated. And we've shown that they've
been misappropriated.
But counsel,
how do we know that anything... anything inappropriate was done? Again, your opponent says, well, you specifically asked him to continue working during that notice period, and in fact not even tell anyone that he was planning to resign, and therefore he was doing his work in the ordinary course and helping people prepare for various meetings, etc. He was allowed to download basic documents about his own employment. What is your best evidence that you were actually harmed by something in the time period before they offered these concessions? Can you just give us your three most concrete points of we have been harmed?
So just on the trade secret piece? Right?
No, the whole case.
On the whole case, yeah. Was that Mr. McNally was paid $1.55 million in cash and $1.4 million in security in exchange for a sale of business non-compete. And he went and joined one of our competitors immediately after resigning. So that obviously is harm. That was a sale of business non-compete that he was handsomely paid for.
Well, you're going to have a lawsuit that's going to go on about that. You're saying we need in the interim of that lawsuit for him to stop working there right now. Why?
Correct. Because the harm, and again, this is the case law in this circuit, as in its sister circuits, the harm from a breach of a non-compete cannot be reduced to damages. Now, you may seek damages, but those damages are inadequate to remedy the competitive harm from breach of that non-compete. And if I may just...
But what is the evidence of a competitive harm? I think that's what I'm asking you. I understand the record is clear that he went to work at another business, obviously. Nobody's contesting that. But what is the actual evidence that you've been competitively harmed by that was in the record before the district court?
Well, Your Honor, this is always the catch in these preliminary injunction cases, right? Because you have to move quickly enough to show that there's urgency and in order to prevent irreparable harm. But, you know, if you move urgently, then you don't have evidence in the record of the loss of market share and the loss of customer relationships and the use of proprietary information and corporate information at the competitor at the time of the filing. So we had to strike that balance. I can't point
and to... And so, I mean, the problem is, so if he's, again, back to your lead argument, so the judge says speculative, and they say, we gave him a letter and Stern, like, you must follow the agreement, and you're saying, and we can't really show exactly what happened that would hurt us. Why can't the judge look and say, I have the letter that says exactly what he needs to do or he'll be fired? They haven't really come forward with anything that's actually really happened. So what they said is speculative. I don't think there's irreparable harm.
A few points to make, Your Honor. Allstate v. Fougere, this court's decision from 2023, said that blanket and unspecific denials of culpability do not serve to rebut evidence of trade secret misappropriation. In that case, the court pointed to just one spreadsheet containing trade secret information that was on the defendant's computers.
Are you able to say what he took? I was unclear on that.
Yes, we're able to. Well, the declaration of our chief operating officer actually goes through the 27 documents that we have visibility into his having taken. and describes them in detail and describes the competitive harm. And our forensic expert also explains what he can see and what he can't see. So with respect to the Google Drive, we can see what he's opened on his Google Drive on his BioAgilytics laptop, which is the only repository in our possession.
The documents you can see, what happened to those? He just still has them?
And he still has them, which goes to our point about misappropriation. Under the DTSA, you have to show that the trade secret, that the information constitutes a trade secret, and they haven't rebutted that except with respect to two documents out of the 27. He claims that it's not proprietary, it's available publicly, et cetera. Okay, that leaves the other 25. Two, you have to show that he acquired or retained it by improper means, which includes through breach of company policy or company agreement. Here we have breach of company policy about the devices and the servers on which you can have BioAgilytics information, and that's at JA 483. And we have breach of Section 7 of the employment agreement, which says if we determine that you have our information on your personal devices, you, first of all, you have to return the information. Second, you have to submit to a forensic remediation of your devices. They declined. They could have complied with the contract and obviated the need for the preliminary injunction motion. And at any time since then, they could have mooted this appeal and perhaps part of the claims that we brought in the district court by allowing us to have an image of those devices.
Can I ask you about that factually, counsel? Because I thought they said in their brief, and you can let me know if you disagree, that before you filed the preliminary injunction motion, Dr. McNally and Sword Bio had already confirmed to your client that they would agree to a quote-unquote reasonably bounded forensic remediation of Dr. McNally's devices.
Absolutely none has taken place, and we can't give any credit to what counsel says they would agree to if, in fact, they did not agree to it at the time of the motion or since.
I'm sorry, I don't understand your answer. They said that they told your client they would do this before you filed the preliminary injunction motion, and then you went ahead and filed it. So,
but there was no agreement. So the Section 7...
But was the lack of agreement from your side?
Well, Section 7 says that we have the right to conduct the forensic inspection. Counsel didn't agree to that. He said, well, we will agree. It's an agreement to perhaps agree in the future. That's not definite. And it's been borne out to the present.
Well, let me ask you more specifically. So I'm looking at page 22 of their brief, if I may. Yes. I'm looking at page 22 of their brief. It's the second bullet point. This is what they said, the reasonably bounded forensic remediation they offered to you. Do you contest that that was offered to your client, what they say there in the bullet point?
We do. We do, because they could have said, this is our forensic expert, Concilio, or whoever it may be. They've imaged the devices. Let's talk about the review of what they found. They didn't offer that, and they haven't offered that. And they can't defeat our claim by saying that they will agree to some amorphous, point when Section 7 of the Employment Agreement lays out exactly what the company is entitled to and what Mr. McNally is obligated to do.
Can we go back to Judge Rickleman's question about your best arguments about irreparable harm? And you started by talking about the sale of the business. Is that it?
That's certainly one aspect when...
So if you had like your three arguments about irreparable harm, what would they be?
Sure. The first is that when Cinven acquired BioAgilytics, it valued the company based on the 19 executives who were required to sign a support agreement, all of whom were paid millions of dollars in exchange for certain restrictive covenants, including the non-compete. He's now at a competitor that's also staffed by many of our former employees. That's competitive harm.
Okay, I understand that.
Two is his retention, continued improper retention of our trade secret material, and Linda Robbie, the COO, has described, these aren't spreadsheets with client information, a few of them are, right? These are hard science, proprietary information type trade secrets.
And that declaration
and the three, which goes to both non-solicitation and non-compete, he immediately was out in the market, and we have in the record LinkedIn posts, et cetera. He went out in the market and presented himself as the new chief scientific officer of Sword Bio at industry conferences that are extremely important in the industry. So Really, all of the harms that typically when someone is bound by a non-compete and they're trying not to abide by it, they're playing nice and they're trying to mitigate the harm that the former employer can claim. And here it was brazen. He took the $3+ million and he went out the next day and he was on the industry circuit. So okay. That would be the third.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would counsel for the appellee, Sword Diagnostics, please introduce herself on the record to begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. Megan Daly on behalf of Sword Diagnostics. With me today is my colleague, Attorney Alley. We are dividing our time today, so for the first 7 minutes, I'm going to address the plaintiff's argument on appeal regarding the sufficiency of the court's order under Rule 52. And for the latter portion of the argument, Attorney Alley will address the merits of the preliminary injunction briefing and motion in order. In its briefing on appeal, the plaintiff describes Judge O'Toole's order denying its request for injunctive relief as, quote, a dereliction of judicial duty and, quote, the complacency which has imperiled plaintiff's property rights. Despite the hyperbolic nature of plaintiff's briefing on appeal, the order clearly fulfills the requirements of Rule 52, which applies to interlocutory injunctions. The full text of that rule states that in granting or refusing an interlocutory injunction, the court must...
Counsel? Yes. If we could just sort of move directly to the heart of the issue. So one of the claims they made here was that he had a non-compete and leaves their client and 2 weeks later starts working at a company that is in a similar line of business that they view as a competitor in clear violation of the non-compete. In reading Judge O'Toole's order, I didn't see any reference even to the non-compete part of the claim. So how should we analyze that? Because we know what the rule requires, but
sure,
just that entire part of their preliminary injunction motion just doesn't seem to be addressed.
Sure. So the first sentence of Judge O'Toole's order first acknowledges that BioAgilytics is seeking injunctive relief as to the non-compete, as well as, quote, other relief. And so I think that sentence encompasses that he's looking at all the claims being asserted, which is the non-compete, the non-solicit, the non-disclosure obligations, and the trade secret claims.
It does, but then the paragraph where the judge goes through some of the arguments doesn't refer to the non-compete at all.
Sure. So I think in my interpretation of the order, I don't want to speak for the district court, but he articulates in that first sentence that he's viewing all of the claims. He cites, for example, as it relates to the non-solicit, a specific example about him attending industry events. That's just one example, and then he makes the generalized conclusion that all of the claims are pretty speculative.
But that's peculiar in the way this thing got briefed, which are complicated questions about this Massachusetts Non-Compete Act, and that's what's going back and forth. And that is, does the regular common law rule apply? Does the statute apply? I mean, that's nuanced stuff that would determine whether this non-compete. Now, I made the best argument I guess I could about irreparable harm, but he doesn't remotely touch any of that.
Right, and I think we're on a preliminary injunction, right? So I don't know that Judge O'Toole has to get into the controlling case law on whether the specific non-restriction provisions are enforceable under Massachusetts law, whether it's in connection with the sale of a business or not. He's looking at whether they...
But if you had a sale of a business, if it was that kind of agreement, and it does appear your client got about, $1.5 million and $1.4 million, so a lot of money, and he signed this agreement, and then he went out, and yet he agreed to, I'll have a 12-month cooling-off period, and then he goes out and he works for a competitor. Assuming like all of those legal arguments I read about aren't right, that seems like a violation of a non-compete that they got, just for the reasons your friend said, they got and they wanted, and that was how they valued their deal, and now they don't get it. And maybe that's right, maybe that's wrong, but like nothing here helps me how to think about that.
Right, and they can certainly pursue their claim for competition harm for monetary damages. The threshold question for the preliminary injunction is whether they've met their burden in establishing irreparable harm amongst the other four factors for a preliminary injunction. Does that answer your
question? So it comes down to, okay, he basically what I said 10 minutes ago. He blew off. He might have blown off the likelihood of success of the non-compete, but his sort of, this is speculative in general, and that applies to all four factors, that's the answer. But it's, if you're violating a non-compete, why isn't it just sort of automatic irreparable harm? Like, what I bargained for is you, person, have a brain and expertise and good thoughts, and I'm going to pay you a lot of money, and I don't want you taking that brain and expertise and good thoughts over to my competitor for a certain period of time. And you agree to that, and I bought that from you. And my irreparable harm is you're taking all of that over to my competitor. I mean, that doesn't seem that complicated.
Right, but it's a balancing of the four factors for the preliminary injunction, right? I mean, Dr. McNally has been in this specific, very narrow industry for almost his entire career. If he's unable to, you know.
And they make the point that that this is a narrow scope, and he could go work for companies themselves, not the companies that help do the, you know, monitor the testing. So, I mean, it just seems it's I'm not clear that what's so speculative, if it is about the non-compete, put the other ones aside, feels like that's what you bargained for, and that if it's not happening, you're sort of irreparably harmed kind of because of the nature of what the complaint is.
Right, but if we can hearken back to the questions that were made to my colleague over here, what was the best evidence of irreparable harm? That he was attending some industry events. He attended one industry event before we got a cease and desist.
No, but I think
from
opposing
them.
Counsel has argued that when it comes to non-competes, violation of the non-compete is essentially irreparable harm, that you shouldn't have to wait and do a damages analysis because the whole reason you entered into the non-compete is because you think the person working there is just, Judge Aframe just explained, in a competitor, it's just going to harm you. That's just the reality of it, and therefore you can essentially, as a matter of law, almost presume irreparable harm. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't think that's the case law in Massachusetts. We obviously also have our defenses under the likelihood of success based on this. I know they make an argument about it's in the connection with the sale of a business. This sale of a business happened over 4 years ago at this point. He stayed there for a subsequent 3 years. It's not like he got his money and ran. The entire deal, enterprise value, was billions of dollars. So I know he did get paid handsomely, but proportional to the full sale value of the business.
I don't see why that even matters. I mean, what they bought from these 19 people was to keep their talent on the sidelines for a certain period of time. And now their talent isn't on the sidelines. It's working for the competitor. I understand you have legal arguments that contract doesn't work for all sorts of reasons, and those very well may be right. But what I guess, back to why you're up here, is Judge O'Toole didn't engage with any of that. And that's what I guess is troubling, because those are hard issues. I mean, I read the briefs, mm-hmm. They're hard. And I don't, you know, so.
Right, I think also in the text of the order, you can see that he mentions a thorough review of the party's briefing on the topics, as well as oral argument, which was lengthy. I mean, the briefs, there's probably a dozen or so competing affidavits, supporting documentation. There is
like one of them is whether or not he had good legal counsel that's required under Matt, right? That's a very fact-intensive idea, because there's some lawyer that maybe didn't represent him. I'm not sure. But that's a fact-intensive argument mm-hmm. that you guys are making about the non-compete. And like that wasn't resolved. Like none of this was resolved. So.
Right. And I'm sure my colleague will address the merits of that in more detail as it relates to the specific issue about the assistance of counsel. Dr. McNally provided a sworn affidavit disputing their assertion that he was provided counsel. In response, they got an affidavit from an individual that no longer works for the company saying, well, hey, I never said whether or not it was enforceable. It's very, to Judge O'Toole's point, speculative and generalized.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just one more question, counsel, that I think is appropriate for you rather than your colleague. Is there anything in the oral argument transcript specifically on the non-compete claim and how the district court was thinking about it?
I mean, certainly the parties presented extensive argument on the non-compete in the application of Massachusetts law, and specifically as it relates to their argument about
No,
the
I understand. I'm just wondering if there's something you would highlight in terms of the district court's thinking during the oral argument, a couple pages of the transcript that you think we should look at.
I don't believe that there is any commentary from Judge O'Toole in the record.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Would counsel for the appellee, McNally, please introduce herself on the record to begin.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Kimberly Alley. I represent Dr. McNally, and I'll be arguing on behalf of both appellees with regard to the preliminary injunction and Judge O'Toole's exercise of discretion in denying BioAgiletics' request for it. BioAgiletics takes the same overreaching approach on appeal that it did in the underlying injunction hearing matter. The standard here is abuse of discretion. Bioegiletics calls it dereliction of duty. Neither is true, and we know that because with abuse of discretion, it exists only if the district court applied an erroneous view of the law and makes a clearly erroneous assessment of the evidence. And that goes to Your Honor's questions here with the evidence. The sum and substance of Bioegiletics' argument is that Judge O'Toole acted in dereliction because he didn't consider unrefuted evidence. It says it throughout its brief. Just because it says that does not make it so. It's the same arguments. It would just assert arguments before Judge O'Toole, but the evidence showed otherwise. And we know that.
What's an argument that defeats the non-compete that requires no factual determination and it's just out of the box legally ends it?
With the non-compete, mm-hmm. because of the issue of significant owner. Take that, for example, under the non-compete statute. Judge O'Toole was looking at competing evidence. He did, during arguments, listen extensively. It was an hour and 15-minute oral argument on this. He gave everyone the opportunity.
Okay, so there's a question of whether Mr. McNally was getting enough share of the deal to be considered significant owner. Do I have the issue right?
Correct. Okay. And in comparison to the deal.
And I mean, is there what some case out there that you can say, in dead bang, these are the facts. It was $1.5 million and $1.4 million in stock. In a deal worth X, that's not a significant owner.
There is not a case like that, and not for lack of looking.
Okay, so isn't that a mixed question? And then he would have to tell us, I don't think that's a significant owner because fill in the rest of the sentence?
I think he did by saying that he conducted a thorough review of the evidence and of the party's written submissions. His words, and those submissions were over 500 pages going extensively into exactly
what you're talking about. So because he says, I know this was the other person's point, but just Rule 52A is supposed to get us out of the box that I think you just put us in, which is, well, there are issues, some are hard, some may be less hard, and you're supposed to take that first sentence as each and everything that went on here, he decided in our favor, and that's what you should take from him saying there was a thorough review. And I guess I'm asking you, like, what's the clearest answer that wouldn't require a judge to make some pretty fine determinations?
You can look at the Iron Mountain case versus Viewpoint that we relied on, and that is a case where there was a written letter that affirmed they were not going to enforce the non-compete, okay? Bioegiletics here says, well, there's no written letter, but what we have was Dr. McNally saying a Mark Beathers, who was the HR representative, told him when he voiced objection to the non-compete in the support agreement that this isn't enforceable against you. You're a Massachusetts resident. You work here. And it's based on that that Dr. McNally signed it. Bioegiletics comes in, they have the resources to go to all the emails, everything they would have in their system, to Mark Beathers, who now is no longer an employee there, and he submits an affidavit, and even though Bioegiletics argues at the injunction hearing that Mark Beathers shows Dr. McNally lied, he lied about things in here, that's not what Mark Beathers' affidavit actually says. It's the joint record extract 597 is his affidavit. His best case scenario on the non-compete is he says, I have no recollection of telling Dr. McNally that the non-compete restriction in the support agreement was not applicable to or enforceable against him in Massachusetts. I do not recall providing legal advice regarding the support agreement. That's written evidence Judge O'Toole had on the non-compete issue to weigh these competing.
And if he said, I don't believe somebody, based on those two things, this is what I conclude, I'm with you.
I understand, and I think he did by saying this is general and speculative, which is language that the judges use all the time. I mean, this isn't a Judge O'Toole's not new to the bench. I mean, he's a veteran.
Counsel, if we sort of take, I think, to your client's benefit and assume this is just an employee non-compete rather than the business sale of business situation, your opposing counsel has argued that under Massachusetts law there's essentially a presumption of irreparable harm. Can you address that? What is your understanding of Massachusetts law for employee non-competes?
If it's established, they have to establish, and that's part of the burden that BioAgiletics had at the hearing at the trial court level to establish there was a violation of the non-compete. I mean, we have, that is a central issue here that will go through trial and be the crux of this, and in light of, you know, the lack of case law on this will probably become some of the case law in this case because it is the central heart of this case. That's exactly what Judge O'Toole was evaluating, and he found it just wasn't enough for this level to establish a likelihood of success and the irreparable harm. And let's not forget, there is zero evidence of irreparable harm that's been put forth by BioAgiletics. There's not one customer. There is nothing in there. I mean, we can look
I thought you just said if the non-compete was enforceable under the law, that is irreparable harm.
It is if they have established it, but
why wasn't there enough to show a violation of the non-compete when he goes to work for somebody in the same line of business 2 weeks later in, you know, a similar role?
Because it's our position the non-compete was not enforceable in Massachusetts, that this was not a transaction.
And you had a whole series of interesting and hard arguments about that.
Correct.
And we're supposed to go off of Judge O'Toole saying, I've read the submissions and it's denied.
And it's also not sufficient to rise to the level of having any presumption that it is irreparable harm.
I guess that the challenge for us, though, counsel, is I think those are three separate issues. So I've been trying to ask you about them one by one. There's the question of whether the non-compete is enforceable. You're now arguing it's not enforceable. There's a whole series of issues about that. Assuming it's enforceable, there's the question of whether there was a violation. You think there wasn't, obviously, but there's a whole set of issues about that. Assuming there was a violation, there's the issue of whether the irreparable harm can be presumed, and then there's disputes about that. We can't tell which one of those three sets of issues may have been the dispositive one here, so that's why I was trying to take you through them one by one. So if we assume that it's enforceable, why wasn't there enough to show a violation here?
Because of the evidence that was before Judge O'Toole, and he was reviewing that and exercised his discretion to say it didn't even meet that minimal level. It was...
Because they're not competitors? I mean, is that why? I mean, he went to work for somebody.
There was substantial evidence about the fact that they weren't competitors. These are different markets.
Right, and that's because one is a mega corporation, one is a very small corporation, right?
And if I may, just to answer that, also because the information was not confidential, proprietary, a lot of this assay information is in the public
and
domain.
And that's about the disclosure, not the non-compete, right? So all these things are all swirling around at the same time.
And overlap one another with the non-compete, which is exactly why if it's not competing, if it's information that is in the public domain, and Dr. McNally can access and use that regardless of what company he goes to.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At this time, would counsel for the appellant please reintroduce himself on the record? He has a 3-minute rebuttal.
Miguel Lopez on behalf of BioAgiletics. Your Honors, just to touch on a few points quickly with respect to Mr. McNally's representation by separate counsel. He and five other executives were represented by separate counsel. This is in the record. JA560 is an email from an attorney of the Weirich firm. Just to update you, I sent our comments to Kirkland and White & Case this evening. Those were the two law firms representing the two sides in the transaction. They reduced the scope of what competitive business is, and they reduced the non-compete from 2 years to 1 year. Further, JA524 is an email the day after his resignation from the CEO to McNally reminding him of his non-compete obligation. So Iron Mountain's not applicable. On irreparable harm, just last month, the Second Circuit in Poor, on behalf of NLRB, that was December 19, 2025, said that a very short text order denying a preliminary injunction because of a lack of irreparable harm violated Rule 52A2 They reversed and remanded with instructions to enter the requested injunctive relief. So it may be a finding in some esoteric sense, but not in the sense required by the rule or by this circuit's interpretation of it, or the Second Circuit's, or I venture to say any circuit's. On enforceability, again, the court did need to have found enforceability of the non-compete, because that is one of the elements of the contract claim, and that's what's required by this court's precedent in TEC Engineering. I would venture to say that what the court should have done at a minimum is go through, if you go to SSJA 002, which is the table of contents in our opening brief below, we break out each claim by its element. Even if it's just a sentence or two, weighing the factors, is there a likelihood of success? Is there irreparable harm that attaches to the conduct being alleged? He needed to have addressed those, and he didn't. And the consequences of violating the rule are myriad. For example, counsel just mentioned proprietary information. Below, they argued that there's no trade secret claim because, in a blanket manner, they said this information is not proprietary. But in discovery, they're trying to quash our subpoenas to third parties on the basis that revealing the documents would endanger their proprietary information. Had he made findings, we would have been able to say, excuse me, they are judicially stopped from making an argument contrary to the one that they relied on in order to prevail at the preliminary injunction stage. So this is a very substantive due process not used in the case law, but really it is a due process right that's protected by Rule 52. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in this case.